You've got to admire the American military personnel who carried out the stealth raid in Venezuela and extracted the socialist tyrant Maduro. Their expertise really is a marvel. But their mission raises a bunch of questions that we do not expect soldiers to answer, such as, does the U.S. president have the authority to order such an action? Is the United States really going to run Venezuela, as President Trump said, or will it take some slightly more modest role, as Marco Rubio seems to suggest? And what will happen to Venezuelans themselves? Let's talk about all this on today's episode of Independent Conversations. Hi, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And I've got experts with me today who've got firsthand knowledge of the crisis and its implications. Let me start with a question to our friend Leonardo Brito, our correspondent in Venezuela, who is with us from Venezuela today. Leo, have things settled down in your capital city, and who's in charge there now?
Hello, Graham, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk about my country. I appreciate. So actually, I don't think nothing is settling me now. We just open a Pandora's box. As you may know, we have many different problems in Venezuela. It's a very complex situation. There's an American saying that it's a small country, big hill, right? So something like that. So right now the regime is actually going after people who in their social media are supporting this U.S. operation. They are, putting a lot of violence in the streets. And for example, yesterday there were shootings in Caracas downtown, nearby the palace, the Miraflores Palace, which is like the Venezuelan White House. And there's a lot of confusion going on. I think this is just the beginning of something that we really don't know what's going to happen. And the person in charge, it's actually the regime. They are still in charge. It's like a hydra with many, many heads. And now Delcy, which is the vice president, is the one that is taking over. And even though the U.S. says that Delcy will comply with the U.S., she in the public, she says she will not comply and that the revolution is still alive and that kind of thing. So,
Is she as much committed to socialism as Maduro himself?
Well, what I fear is not only that she's a socialist, Marxist, but also that she's smarter than Maduro. She and her brother are very smart people. They are the only ones at the top that went to college, for example. So they are the only ones with education in the elite. And I'm not really sure if, when Trump said that they will provide billions and billions of dollars to Venezuela to rebuild it, if he gives that amount of money to Delcy Rodriguez and the Rodriguez brothers, that's going to be a huge mistake. They're going to be stealing money from taxpayers.
I'm afraid from an American perspective, it kind of reminds me of the billions that were released to the Islamic Republic in Iran under President Biden, which just seemed to strengthen them. And you're telling us that if these billions are released to the current crowd in Caracas, the ruling crowd, that it could reinforce their power toward all the wrong ends. Is that what you're saying?
So there are some successes, but honestly, if you take a look at most of the U.S. intervention, the interventions are good, but the bad thing is the aftermath, what comes after. We've seen that in many countries that, once the business is done, then hell starts loose. I don't want to be negative about this because I'm very happy about what happened. But in the same time, I'm afraid that there's no plan for the next stage, especially with the midterm elections coming. I don't think the U.S. wants to be involved in a huge operation. But honestly, the only way we can succeed in this is that we have a full ground occupation. And I don't see that coming.
Yeah, hard to see it. I mean, let me just turn to my colleague, Gabriel Gasave. Gabriel is a member of the Independent Institute team, and he oversees our work in Latin America and the Spanish-speaking world. Can you imagine, Gabriel, a serious and maybe semi-long-term U.S. occupation, or do you agree with Leo that that's unlikely?
Well, Graham, the last Saturday events triggered talks about an eventual peaceful transition in Venezuela, which is not possible right now. There is still peace or relative peace, but there is no real transition. Some people, the pessimists, think that the process is already over, that the regime lost its head but stayed in place, and Trump will be happy with a sort of Madurism without Maduro, which a regime that he can make business. He mentioned the word oil several times in his speech last Saturday. And others, the people who is most optimistic, they think that this was the first step of another three steps. First was avoid chaos, second, rebuild the state, and a third step could be restore democracy. We don't know if there is a plan in the Trump administration. There are different point of view. Apparently, Trump himself minimized the role of Corina Machado. I don't know if it was on purpose just to protect her and not to make her look like a U.S. Puppet, or there is something else involved, or he feels better making deals with Delcy Rodriguez. I think that it's not Venezuela. It's not the same that Afghanistan or Iraq or other or Libya or Syria that could be the ground for a long-term occupancy by the U.S. forces. That's my point of view, but Ivan here is the expert in this series.
We're going to jump to Ivan in a minute, but I want to just go back to Leo first for a second. So our friend Gabriel mentioned Maria Corina Machado. When I first heard about the intervention by the U.S. forces, I thought to myself, oh, great, now they're going to put Machado in place. President Trump says she doesn't have enough respect. Could that be accurate, that she doesn't have enough respect? I mean, she won, 93% in the opposition primary in 2023, and then her candidate, Gonzalez, won, 67% last year in the national election. But does she not have enough respect, Leo? Was that accurate?
So I think Maria Corina is highly supported by most of Venezuelans. I would say 80% of Venezuelans, without giving you, you know, a mistake. They really support her. So she has the support of the people, but she doesn't have respect in the armed forces. And she doesn't have the capacity with the military. And there are also other gangs. So we have several gangs. It's not just Tren de Aragua or Cartel of the Suns. So Venezuela is basically run by many different gangs that if Machado takes power, on day one, they will, you know, take her out because of the criminal capacity they have. So it's a very complex situation. She has the 80% of the people love her, but she doesn't have the capacity or the institutional power or the agreement with the military to really grasp on the power of the land.
So could it be that President Trump's at least initial reluctance to put her in a position of power may have some merit? Maybe he's has some wisdom there? Could that be what you're saying?
Yes. I'm not sure if what did he mean by saying that, but he's right in the fact that she cannot be the leader, not yet. We still need to do a cleaning process before we can actually go into transition, elections, and all of that, because it's really a mess. And the more you research on Venezuela, you see the deeper the mess we have.
but it seems like there's a huge support among the Venezuelan people for that process of cleaning up and getting ready for elections. Is that true?
Well, that's true, but they cannot openly talk about that. So it's a mixed thing. So people want the change, but they cannot support openly the change unless they are abroad, of course.
So right now, apparently, the regime powers are watching out and looking for people who are supportive of the U.S. and not supportive of the regime and trying to silence them. Apparently, that's what I've read. That seems true to you still, right?
Yeah, that's true. So what they have is they put a lot of checkpoints, okay, everywhere, because they don't have like the technological capacity. But what they do is they put checkpoints, and where you're driving, let's say from one state to the other, you cross through the checkpoint, you have a lot of military. So they check your phone, your social media, and they see, oh, this guy is posting in pro of Trump intervention. So they take you to prison. You have no lawyers. You have no rights. You have nothing. Your family will never know about you. So it's that's the way they operate. So it's not like they go after you in your house. It's more like if you expose yourself, then they come after you. So you better keep quiet.
Wow. I'm going to turn to our other colleague here, Ivan Eland. Ivan Eland is a senior fellow and director of our Center on Peace and Liberty. So, Ivan, you know a lot about the international law issues here. I posed a question at the beginning that I was thinking of you when I asked it. And this is a little more theoretical than immediately practical, I guess. But does a U.S. president have the authority to order such a military action in a foreign capital?
No. Not under international law, it's very clear. Yeah, you can only do so under three things. You have to be invited in, which was not the case, or you have to claim self-defense, legitimate self-defense, which was not the case here. And the third one is that you got to get a UN Security Council resolution. Now, if you want to talk U.S. law, that's a different story, but it's still very shaky. And in international custom, it's a sovereign head of state by the culture of international relations. You usually don't take out either by assassination or by doing something like this, because other people can do it to you. It's like torture. If the U.S. does it to other soldiers, they'll do it to us, and they won't surrender. You know, there's reasons why these informal rules are set up, and that's an informal rule, but that's not done either. So. And of course, it's a little more complicated with U.S. law, and there's a debate. But the original founders of the United States would have frowned on something like this with no congressional authorization.
Slightly detour into devil's advocate. So one could say, when you get asked the question, what right did Trump have to do that intervention? The answer is none. But what right did Maduro have to rule Venezuela? None. He had been rejected by the voters. He messed up and distorted the election results. So neither of them really had a right to rule in Caracas. So isn't that even, Stephen?
Well, not really. I mean, if you want to go by the founders' vision, John Quincy Adams said in a speech, "We don't seek monsters to destroy." There's a lot of problems in the world. There's a lot of oppression. But when we go do stuff like this, it erodes our own republic. We need to get, and if we do it, we need to get congressional authorization beforehand. So if you want to do something like this, it should be thoroughly debated beforehand. And, you know, they're claiming that it's, you know, would have been leaked out or whatever. And yes, you keep the tactical operation as to when you're going to do it, how you're going to do it, et cetera. But you need some sort of a debate as to whether this is a right policy, at least in the United States to do. So it's not even. And there's a lot of regimes that should be taken out around the world. And I'm certainly not defending Maduro in any sense, because we all know he's a socialist and he's run the economy there into the ground, and he's been
Leo
very
called
repressive.
Him a Marxist.
What? Yes.
Leo called him a Marxist a moment ago.
Yes. Well, we can debate. It's not good, no matter what the label is. But
right.
Yes. But it's trending that way. Yes. But anyway, I mean, the original conception was we interact with other countries. We act as an example of free markets and non-intervention. But of course, that went away after World War II, when the U.S. became the most interventionist country in the world. And many, and especially in Latin America, where we had the Monroe Doctrine, this is a very sensitive subject in many countries when they run afoul of the U.S. for one reason or another.
So this is really interesting. Ivan is largely speaking to us from the frame of reference of American constitutionalism and our own rules about the use of our own power. But at the beginning of this conversation, Leo said something along the lines of, you were glad for the intervention, or you welcomed it. You're not worried about the niceties of American constitutional law. You're just thinking about the misery of Venezuelans. Is that right, Leo?
Yes. So we have to understand that Venezuela is already intervened by a foreign power. We are intervened by Iran, by China, and by Russia. So our country really don't belongs to the Venezuelan. And also, Cuba is the owner of the political apparatus. As you may know, the 80 people who were killed on the Maduro security forces, they were Cuban, actually. So Venezuela is already an invaded state by foreign forces taking over their economy and everything. We have, for example, Hezbollah and Hamas training base camps here. We
in
have,
Venezuela?
Yes. That was actually discovered by the Center for a Secure Free Society and the CIA, like in 2017. And we provide passports to terrorists. We have Iranian drones, factories, and Russian equipment for military stuff. So it's in Venezuela's point of view, we are already a colony, and our oil and resources and everything, they are already being taken away by foreign people. So when we see the U.S. coming, from our point of view, we don't see it as something like, oh no, now we're going to be invaded. That's not the way we see it. Like we are already invaded, and you know, this is an opportunity for us to be free. So, yeah, it's a point
very
of
interesting. Gabrielle, if you want to weigh in here, please feel free. I have a question for you in a minute, though.
Yes, well, I see a great irony among libertarians in Latin America, because a Latin American libertarian will always oppose to their own government control the price of milk or the rent. But when it comes to the U.S., they support the interventions abroad and being paid by the U.S. taxpayers, no? It's not for free. So there is a sort of contradiction that it's something that they don't allow to their own governments, they support when it is the U.S., the country that they're making those interventions. The U.S. should be an example, as it was at the beginning, 250 years ago, of a successful revolution and the ideals of the founding fathers implemented in a proper way. So it's a difficult situation to talk these days with libertarian people in particular, which is the people that I deal the most with, to talk about these issues, because there are many mixed emotions involved in this situation. I'm happy that Maduro was removed, but I don't agree with the way he was removed, but someone can tell me there was no other way. If the U.S. didn't do it, nobody will do it. So it was going to never happen. So it's difficult.
Yeah, there are some ironies or paradoxes there for sure. And I'm just reflecting on what Leo said a few minutes ago. Maybe the reason that pro-liberty forces in Latin America are against their own government's use of power to control and more happy when the Americans use their power to control, maybe it's because the Americans have a little better track record at respecting liberty than their own dictators do.
Maybe that's the reason why, yeah? I agree.
A little better. I'm not saying perfect, but Leo, please weigh in if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, well, you even heard Javier Milei, which is probably the most libertarian president we have right now, supporting the intervention in Venezuela. So here's a problem. We have a lot of, I would say, human suffering. And when you have a lot of human pain and human suffering and families separating and stuff like that, you know, the economic books and the theories and all the utopic things and the academics, they don't resolve, you know, very fast the for people that want solutions quick. So you go to accept what reality is, you know, the real world, the real that, you know, it's not like we want it in the books, but it is what we have. If you imagine that you are in a prison, or let's say you are in a concentration camp, you just want to be free. You don't care, especially if you don't have guns or means to defend yourself. The other day I read about the Warsaw ghetto in Poland. So these people were living there, and the Germans gave them food and stuff, but they tried to be against the Germans many times. They revolted and they tried to do many stuff, but eventually they were all killed and they were sent to the Auschwitz concentration camp. So in that situation, if you live in a place like that, so you really don't care a lot about Hayek or Mises or Milton Friedman. You really want solutions, and especially libertarians in Latin America, we're very little. We're very few. Don't imagine we are a strong force in Venezuela or Colombia. We're not that big, and we don't have the power of influence to, you know, say things how they should be. Venezuelan people have been fighting for maybe 26 years, and we tried everything, and we came up to the realization we're not going to make it without guns. And so this is, I know it's a contradiction, but there's a human thing in the middle, and the suffering, you know, and the many things. So that's how you cannot explain it in an easy way, because it's not easy. It's not academic. It's not even about values that we defend. It's about people who are starving and they want to eat, you know?
Your example of Poland toward the end of World War II is pretty interesting. I mean, if you were in Auschwitz or elsewhere suppressed by Nazi Germany, you'd be glad to be liberated by the Russian army, but you'd be even more glad to be liberated by the American army.
Right. You will see Russians like angels.
Yeah, you would, right. But you'd rather see Americans if you could.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Definitely, yeah.
So all of this is pretty complicated, which leads us, I think, back to Ivan. Ivan is good with complications. So we've heard from our Venezuelan correspondent that from the Venezuelan point of view, the country has long already been invaded, Ivan, by Iran, China, Russia, Cuba, et cetera. Does that kind of factual thing on the ground, Ivan, does that have any mitigation on the international principle of non-intervention against sovereign states?
Well, I think, you know, we talk about principle, but there's some actually, I don't think it does, not from a U.S. perspective, if you want to keep a free society here. I mean, we have an empire, an informal empire, but an empire nonetheless, and we are $38 trillion in debt. So we have our own domestic considerations here. And war is the biggest cause of big government in human history and in U.S. history and in other most other countries' history. And so I think you have to deal with that fact, and you shouldn't use military force unless you have to. And I think there's some very real problems, complications. And I think Leo put his finger on it when he said, you know, Machado has all this popular support, but she doesn't have support of the armed forces or the internal security forces or the intelligence agencies. And that's a big problem, because the only way you can really rip out this regime is to have a ground invasion with army, not Marines. These force packages that they have don't correspond to anything. They're way, if you want to plank boats, you know, they have way too many forces on station, and the forces erode when they're sitting there for a long time. So the U.S. attention span isn't going to wane, because they're at minimum, they're going to have to sub out those ships, because the sailors can't be on there forever. And so they're going to have but they've got way too many forces just to interdict these little drug boats. If they want to take out, if they want to follow tankers around and interdict those, they could do that. They don't have the right ships, because the Coast Guard does that, and there's not enough Coast Guard ships. Okay, let's go to the scenario that actually happened to take out Maduro. Well, they have far too many forces to do that. That could have been done. It's an extraction regime. It's very difficult to do that, and they did it. They did a good tactical job of it. But the problem is, of course, as we've been talking about, what comes next? If you really want to root out these security forces and root out the regime, you're going to have to go in there. They only have 15,000 Marines, and that's not enough. Venezuela is a big country. Look what happened in Iraq. They told Bush, you're going to need at least 200,000 troops, and he ignored them, and they ended up putting 220,000 troops in Iraq, and they still couldn't subdue them. No. So yeah, occupation, you need a whole lot more. They can go in and wreck the place in no time at all. We have high tech, everything. But if you really want to root out the regime, you're going to have a land invasion with a lot of army troops. When your war gets serious, you bring the army, because the Marines are small. They're very effective, but they're very small. So you have to bring the big boys, and the big boys need a land base. They don't do, well, they did in World War II, but they don't tend to do amphibious assaults, and even the Marines don't do amphibious assaults anymore, because it's very dangerous. But the Army, where are you going to put the Army to do this? Colombia is an unfriendly country. They have a leftist ruler. Brazil is an unfriendly country, leftist ruler. I think the only other hope would be Guyana, but the front, if you look at the map, the border is so, you know, it's not very big. So there's
it's remote and densely tropical.
Right. That's the other problem. So you really don't have a way to do a ground invasion. And then, of course, Trump, philosophically, in his MAGA movement, they don't like forever ground wars. And so, you know, now you can do what he's going to hope to do, I think, is to threaten the existing regime. I knew when he said that speech on Saturday, you could tell they made a deal, and they've been the regime, the remaining people in the regime, have been talking to him for months, and they basically sold out Maduro, and they're going to work with him, because there's evidence to show that they were negotiating behind the scenes, but with these people, and they're as bad as Maduro is, but I think, you know, they're smoother. I heard several people, ambassadors, and even the guy who was Grinnell, who's in the Trump administration, he thought they ought to deal with this woman, Rodriguez, because apparently she, in person, she seems very reasonable. Now, of course, we all know that she's a Marxist and an extremist, but she plays well in the negotiating table. So she's probably convinced them that they can do this. And I think what my view is, and this is speculation, they're going to just say, oh, yeah, well, you know, we're going to cooperate. But there's only limited coercion that you can get by sitting offshore and bombing them every once in a while. So they're going to pretend they're doing it right. And they may get some oil rights or whatever. But I don't think they're going to I don't think Trump in his 5 years, he has taken, I think he's got a toy now, and he's threatening other countries like Cuba and Greenland and Mexico and Colombia in the past few days. And I think he thinks he's got this. I can take out your leader when I want. But there was a certain amount of luck that they got him. I mean, he was at the presidential palace. That's kind of stupid if you're on the run. I guess he didn't think they would do it or something. I don't know, because that's not where you want to be if the U.S. is after you. But anyway, so I don't want to go on and on, but it's going to be very difficult for them to sit offshore and have the leverage. Man is a terrestrial animal, and he lives on the ground, and, you know, air and naval power are potent, but you got to occupy the regime, and you got to take it out, and then you got to decide how many people in the regime you're going to keep. And they blew it in Iraq by taking out too many, but you can take out too few too. So, you know, there's all these considerations, and I just don't think Trump is, his movement doesn't want him to do it. I think so far he's taken out the Iran, number two guy in Iran, and he's bombed in the first term, and he bombed the Iranian nuclear facilities, but they're hit and go things like this was. So we'll see if he's got the attention span to continue this.
I'm going over to Gabriel for a moment. This conversation thus far makes me realize how difficult it is for the U.S. to really control what they might want to control. And, you know, the obstacles, both legal and practical and geographical. But, Gabriel, you're from Argentina. What if there were a coalition of Argentina, Uruguay, Panama, Costa Rica, Chile, Bolivia now? Could a Latin American joint force pick up where the U.S. really can't and be less alien, more welcome by Venezuelans? Is this a pipe dream, Gabriel?
Well, I think so. They can give a theoretical support, but not practical. Argentina has no military power at all. And also, the president in Argentina is in a strange position, because he was a great supporter of Maria Corina Machado. He traveled to Oslo to the event when the Nobel Prize was awarded to her. And now he listens to Trump, minimizing her role in a new government eventually. So it's the situation could be theoretical and in international forums, but in practical terms, it's not going to be possible. But also, Graham, after what I was listening to Ivan describing all the resources and people that would be needed for the U.S. to control Venezuela, I was thinking that in a few days, we will start preparing our income tax here in America. So if you think about the things that you cannot purchase, or the sacrifices that you have to make, and at the same time you listen to your government trying to be the police of the whole world, you think, well, this is crazy. This is insane. So I understand the people that is suffering in Venezuela or somewhere else, but there is a point that the U.S. cannot get involved in everything everywhere, and people themselves have to think about what kind of regime they chosen in the past and how to face it. In Argentina, for instance, we had Juan Domingo Perón, who was overthrown 80 years ago in 1955 by a military and civil coup. But the Peronist mindset, the Peronist mentality, is still in the minds of many, many Argentinians, and the main province of Argentina, Buenos Aires, is still governed by a Peronist. So we have to blame ourselves, the Argentinians, for what we had. And I think that the Venezuelans should do the same and realize that the U.S. can give a hand and or can give some support, but it's it's not their duty to do that, like in anywhere else.
We got to turn back to Leo for a minute here, obviously, at this point. So back when this all began, Leo, is it true that the majority, at least, of Venezuelans wanted Chavez and wanted Chavismo to take over their country? Was that a voluntary choice at the start?
Oh, no, that is not true. We had a lot of what we call the abstention. The abstention is that people don't vote. So we have 11 million people registered to vote. And you know how many people elected Chavez? It was 3.5 million. 3.5 million people elected Chavez in a country of 30 million. And the next contender after Chavez...
3.5 million? 3.5 yes. million out of a country of 30 million.
Right. And the next guy lost for minus than 500,000 votes. But what happened is that people didn't show up. They didn't want to vote because it was a way of saying, we don't want to do anything with this political class. We hate political parties. We had a lot of corruption going on back then, and it was a failing democracy, a failing state already, and there was a lot of poverty, and that's a great cocktail for populist people to take over. So yeah, the idea that we chose, and of course after that every election was rigged, and it was he did many things, not only the Dominion voting machine system, way too many things before that took place. So the way that after that they control the population and the civil society and shut down everyone that was against them and took the guns, because that was one of the first things that Hugo Chavez did, taking into power. And in 2002, we tried a coup. The civil society, we united together, the business sector, and the workers, the unions, even churches, Catholic churches, we came together and we made a coup against Chavez in 2002. And we actually won the coup, but the military power restored him into power. So it's difficult when you don't have the guns to really, you know, do... It's, as I'm telling you, this is real world. This is not a... academic things that sound really good, but you cannot really apply.
So a difference here between Argentina and Venezuela, I think that Perón and Peronism had wide popular support back in the day, and there's still a lot of wide popular support, but it sounds like Chavez and Chavismo really never had wide popular support, unlike Peronism. Does that seem fair, Gabriel? Is my summary fair?
Oh, yes, I agree. I agree with that. But my point is that if we don't change our mentality, we can't overthrow whoever is in power at a certain point, but the idea will remain in the society. I mean, we should help Venezuela not to be a mere democracy that every 4 years they vote for someone who is going to control everybody's life. We should help Venezuela to desocialize, to implement a free economy, an open society, as a rule of law system. But it's not easy. It takes years, and you have to face indoctrination that the students supposedly had been having during the 2.5 decades. So, but that's the point, that we have to focus on that, not in the people that circumstantially is in power. It should be the mentality change and removed from the minds of people to have a change, a real change in the long term.
Bear, can I may add one point there? I think Gabriel's right. And I think more generally, they did a study that showed that when you impose democracy by an invasion force or coercion or whatever, It doesn't really last very long, even if you can get it done. And they used a 10-year period, and they studied it. And there were very few cases where democracy put in that way lasted. I think you really do. It takes much longer, and there's a lot of suffering. But the organic revolutions that happen, I think, are the best, because you do change people's mindset that they're not Peronists or Chavistas or what country. But and it's a long road, and it's not pretty. But it'll be more long lasting if it's done by the people themselves.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think Leo must have a comment on that point.
Yeah, well, that's the theory of social change that Friedrich Hayek said, and that's true. Everything starts with ideas and with the academics, but what if ideas are not allowed to be shared and spread? For example, I used to run a think tank here in Venezuela, and we were very successful. We had over 50 meetings a year, 2,000 people, teenagers and youth enroll in courses, many, many things going on. But right now we're not allowed to do anything. We even have friends in prison. So if you want to change mentalities and change mindset, you have to be allowed to do that. Because if not, let's say we just wait until the system collapses, like the Soviet Union, you know, it took 71 years to collapse. And then, you know, okay, the system collapsed and now everything. Well, we have a lot of corruption, a lot of things going on. You had the Russian mafia, you had the cronies, you had a culture, basically. And now we have Putin, and they're going back to the Soviet Union. So it's sometimes changing ideas is very difficult, but you have to be allowed. You have to be free in order to express the ideas. And I think that the problem in Venezuela, more than ideas, is that the main issue is that it's too rich. And there's a reason why 90 or 95% of the oil countries are always monarchies or autocracies. It's because when you have so much wealth, you create a lot of interest. So the best thing would be that we privatize. But how do you put the oil in private hands without taking political power? So let's say, okay, I want the government to be smaller. Okay, in order to do that, you need to take political power. But if we don't involve in the fight and we just, you know, try to say it's going to happen eventually, so it's going to be organic. I mean, part of that is true, but also the other part is true. It's like a diamond. It has many faces. So in Venezuela, it's really a mess. It's a difficult thing. We cannot have a formula. We cannot say this is what's going to happen. It's very difficult. But a good thing is that people use, for example, VPNs and VPN and Bitcoin, crypto stuff. So the good thing is that there are some little liberty things that, you know, are growing. And I put my hope into that. And as a believer, I also think this is a spiritual fight too, because these guys are really demonic. But there are many, many things going on, even Muslim influence. It's really a mess. We don't know what's going to happen. And probably if the U.S. does nothing here, this will go even crazy. If the U.S. keeps the things like they are, so there will be a lot of internal conflicts and people trying to take over and the power. And, you know, it's going to be a greater mess than we have now.
I wonder if it might be prove ultimately possible that the U.S. interest in the oil reserves in Venezuela could be put to good use rather than ill use. For example, President Trump made a lot of comments about the value of Venezuelan oil, understandable. But Secretary of State Rubio commented a couple days ago that actually the value should be made, it should be made clear that the beneficiaries of the oil wealth should be the Venezuelan people. And if U.S. power could somehow move the oil wealth and use it as leverage toward the well-being of the Venezuelan people. Maybe there could be a series of small steps. Maybe some of the steps will be messy, but maybe things could move in a healthy direction. We have to draw to a close here because we're running out of time, but I have to just say at the end here that Venezuela is an incredible country. I mean, it was for decades one of the most sophisticated, successful cosmopolitan countries, especially Caracas, was an exceptional world capital. The productivity of the Venezuelan people was amazing, both in business and in the arts. Venezuela could be that way again. And so I'm not going to give up hope, but it sure sounds messy, Leo. And we are thinking of you, and you've got all of our sympathy.
Thank you.
So with that said, you're welcome. You're welcome. With that said, I just have to thank you to our friend Leo coming to us from Venezuela. Thank you so much to Ivan Eland, who keeps us on the straight and narrow with regard to constitutional principle, and Gabriel Gasave, who understands the lay of the land throughout Latin America. Thank you, Ivan. Thank you, Gabriel. And most of all, thank you to Leo, and we wish you all the best, and let's keep in touch. Thanks for joining us, everybody, on Independent Conversations. You're most welcome, and I invite our friends who are watching us to join us through our website, independent.org, where there are already a number of interesting analyses of the situation in Venezuela have been published and posted on our website, independent.org. Again, visit us for some good material on that subject, and join us again next time on Independent Conversations. Take care, everybody.